It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Dorman reporting. The death of the world's longest reigning monarch, Thailand's King Bhumibol Adulyadej, at the age of 88. Stunning blow for a kingdom of 67 million people, most of whom have known no other sovereign. Reporter Ron Corbin tells us that the king's influence in the country was great.
He was influential not because he was involved with the politics directly, but because of his particular personal presence. Also, he was one that maintained a level of moral righteousness. He said when he ascended the throne back in 1950 that he said, we will reign with righteousness for the benefit and happiness of the Siamese people.
Bhumibol's son and heir apparent, the country's crown prince, has said he wants to mourn the loss of his father before ascending to the throne. King had been in poor health for a long time, primarily spending his last years at a Bangkok hospital. Nigerian officials say 21 of the so-called Chibok girls kidnapped by the militant group Boko Haram in 2014 have been released. Boko Haram kidnapped nearly 300 girls from a secondary school in the Borno state town of Chibok in April 2014. Dozens escaped, but 219 remained captive. U.S. military says it struck three radar sites in Yemen in response to missile launches from territories controlled by the Houthi rebels that targeted a U.S. Navy destroyer. Wednesday was the 16th anniversary of a terror attack in Yemen that killed 17 Americans from the guided missile destroyer, the USS Cole, in Aden Harbor. This is VOA News. This world's new World Disaster Report warns that thousands of people are being lost and property destroyed from natural disasters because government and local communities are failing to prepare for these potentially calamitous events. That story now from Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
An analysis of 20 years of data shows earthquakes and tsunamis are the biggest overall killers, followed closely by climate-related disasters, which have more than doubled over the period. The report, however, notes over the past 15 years, weather-related disasters, including drought, heat waves, floods, and storms, have become the main cause of loss of life. Haiti tops the list of the 10 countries with the most disaster deaths, followed by Indonesia and Myanmar. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
In U.S. politics, campaigning for Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, First Lady Michelle Obama spoke about lewd remarks regarding women by Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump on a video made 11 years ago and released last week. Since then, several women have come forward accusing Trump of inappropriate behavior. He says he has substantial evidence to dispute their claims and that he will make them public at an appropriate time very soon. The political website Real Clear Politics says Clinton has a 6-point lead nationally over Trump with the election less than a month away. American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan has won the 2016 Nobel Prize in Literature, the first songwriter to receive the award. 75-year-old musician launched his career in 1959 by performing in coffee houses in the Midwestern state of Minnesota, where he was born in the city of Duluth. Laura Selnor is a Duluth musician.
I think that Duluthians do feel a sense of pride with Bob Dylan being born here, and I think that he did have a big influence on the songwriting.
Dylan's best-known works are from the 1960s, when songs like Blowin' in the Wind became anthems for the anti-Vietnam War and civil rights movements. He also won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008 for his contributions to music and to American literature. Turning now to business news, Samsung Electronics said today that the discontinuation of its Galaxy Note 7 mobile phone would cost the company about $3 billion during the current and next quarters. This would bring the total cost of the recall to at least $5.3 billion. Some Note 7 phones have caught fire due to battery overheating.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Friday, October 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar has broken his silence, saying President Salva Kiir's forces tried to kill him.
They had ground forces pursuing us. They had the helicopter gunships, and they also had one drone and two surveillance planes. I was being attacked, despite that I was also the first vice president of the republic.
That's Riek Machar speaking exclusively to VOA from South Africa. Meanwhile, South Sudan's government says it will not accept a hybrid court in the country. 21 Chibok girls kidnapped by Boko Haram have been freed, and Antonio Guterres has been finally approved as the next Secretary General of the United Nations.
The dramatic problems of today's complex world can only inspire a humble approach, one in which the Secretary General makes his good offices available, working as a convener, a mediator, to help find the solutions that benefit everyone involved.
That's former Portuguese Prime Minister Antonio Guterres. African Union peacekeepers in Somalia struggle to counter improvised explosive devices. And a movie tries to change attitudes towards female genital mutilation. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar says the guarantors of the August 2015 peace agreement must call an urgent meeting of South Sudan political parties to address the current instability in the country. Machar told VOA in an exclusive interview on Thursday that there can be no peace in South Sudan until outstanding issues are resolved. Machar fled South Sudan in July this year after fighting broke out between his supporters and President Salva Kiir's army. He was rescued by United Nations forces and taken to the Democratic Republic of Congo. From there, Machar went to Sudan, where he received medical treatment. He is now in South Africa for additional medical treatment. From there, Machar tells viewers John Tanza that President Kiir's forces tried to kill him.
If I had a plan to fight in Juba, I would have waited until the number 2,910 was ordered in Juba. But I didn't wait for that because I wanted the implementation of the agreement to be done fast. So when we were pushed out, I withdrew the troops. We moved South Baria, then we moved to Lanya area, then from there to the areas of Mundri, from Mundri to Maridi, and then moved south to the Congo. That took exactly 37 days. If you add the 3 days of the fighting, we were under fire for over 40 days.
And who was fighting you as you were moving from Mundri, Maridi, and then to Congo? Who was fighting you?
The SCLA, because basically, when I withdrew, I was in communication with President Salva. I told him that there is a need for both of us to meet. But then when they pushed us out from Juba, I realized that it was just impossible for both of us to meet. So I decided to withdraw to a country which I would be secure in and then find a way of having that meeting with President Salva. They had ground forces pursuing us. They had the helicopter gunships, MI-24. They had four of them. And they also had one drone and two surveillance planes that were daily on our head, locating where we were marching, and then the helicopter gunships would follow and bombard us, and then the troops that are following us would attack us. All that period, I was being attacked, despite that I was also the first vice president of the republic. I didn't see the reason why I would be attacked.
When you left Juba, President Kiir told a Kenyan journalist that during the fighting at the J1, that's the presidential palace, that you had a pistol on you and you wanted to kill him.
Oh my God, this is a big lie. I, Riek Machar, do not carry pistol or gun since 1991, when I began to lead either a party or troops. I don't carry pistol. Why would I carry a pistol when he has called me for a meeting in J1? It's not my habit to carry a pistol.
Dr. Machar, what is the next move now? I remember when you met with the senior leadership of your party in Khartoum, you issued a statement saying you are calling for resistance. What does that mean?
The new government is not a transitional government of national unity. They should not delude the international community of this. The current government is a new regime, but it is not implementing the agreement. The reason why the attempt on my life in J1 was a rejection of the agreement. Because what were we discussing? We were discussing the issues that were pending. The five countries that are representing the five regions in Africa, and also the Troika and the UN. Since these are, some of them are grantors, some of them are witnesses, they have to find a way of facilitating this agreement. Once it is resuscitated, people accept that there has been violations, and then the need for reinstituting the transitional government becomes the first step to be done.
That's former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar speaking from South Africa in an exclusive interview with VOA's John Tanza. South Sudan says it will not accept the setting up of a hybrid court in the country to try those accused of committing gross human rights abuses during the country's violent conflict. Information Minister Michael Makwi says the government has a credible judicial system to try anyone accused of committing crimes in the country. This comes after Amnesty International and the International Federation for Human Rights called on the African Union to expedite the establishment of the hybrid court in the country. Tito Justin has more from Juba.
The hybrid court is an international criminal court which is part of the August 2015 peace agreement signed by President Kiir and former First Vice President Riek Machar. The African Union was supposed to set up the hybrid court months ago to try all alleged war crime suspects, but it has yet to be established. Government spokesperson Michael Makwe says the courts of South Sudan are competent to try individuals who committed murder, looted property, and raped women and girls during the fighting which began in December 2013. Despite the Kiir administration's agreement to create a hybrid court, Makwe says South Sudanese are capable of solving their own problems through the country's courts.
There is no question of us going to ICC or to the hybrid court. When you talk of such things, it means that you don't recognize your own system.
He says a hybrid court should only be established under laws enacted by the National Legislative Assembly and argues that hybrid courts may not be allowed to operate in South Sudan if the terms and conditions of the courts do not match the laws of South Sudan.
It is an ad hoc court established specifically for South Sudan only. And once it disposes of whatever cases to do with this rebellion, definitely it goes.
International humanitarian aid agencies say the July fighting in Juba left at least 300 people dead and forced tens of thousands of others to flee their homes. The United Nations reported that hundreds of crimes were committed against civilians, including the rape of teenage girls by men in military uniform in Juba. South Sudan is not a party to the International Criminal Court or ICC. Legal experts say the ICC has no jurisdiction over crimes committed during the ongoing conflict in South Sudan. Makwe insists that crimes committed in South Sudan cannot be investigated by international bodies.
There is nothing called global justice. These are terminologies which are created for whatever is global. Because in some countries, homosexuality is not a crime. To us here in South Sudan, it is a crime. Gay marriages is not a crime, but to us here in South Sudan, it is a crime.
Human Rights Watch, South Sudan Law Society, and other rights groups have repeatedly stated that South Sudan's justice system is compromised and not capable of trying suspects of crimes committed in the country since December 2013. South Sudan's Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila Onango told reporters in August that his ministry lacks the capacity to try soldiers suspected of committing rape and other crimes during violence in Juba and elsewhere across the country. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 14th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com.
Let's send shout out to these listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya, Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon, and Radio Hot Cocoa also in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The Nigerian-based Bring Back Our Girls campaign group has called on the government to ensure the release of the rest of the abducted Chibok girls who are still being held by Boko Haram militants. Members of the Bring Back Our Girls group say they have issued a one-month ultimatum to the government to locate and rescue the rest of the girls. This came after Nigerian officials said 21 of the Chibok girls kidnapped by Boko Haram in 2014 had been released. Emma Shehu, a leading member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign group, told VOA's Peter Clotty that local and international pressure seems to have forced the government to negotiate the release of some of the abducted girls.
Well, today is a very good day for us. It's been 913 days since the girls were abducted, and today 21 their release has been negotiated. This is rather very late for most of the girls because of the trauma they've gone through, but it's better than nothing. And therefore, we are demanding, as usual, that the girls, those who are still in captivity, their release must be negotiated as quickly as possible because any further delay is inimical to their safety. And so we keep insisting, as we have done since we started this advocacy, that every girl must be accounted for.
The government is saying that it's doing everything possible to ensure the release of the other abducted school girls from Chibok. However, your critics are saying that you were harsher on the previous government than this government, and that you appear to have colluded with this present administration, so you have not been forthcoming in putting a lot of pressure on this administration. What do you say to that?
No, that's not true. Everybody has seen that it was the pressure that we put on this administration that has resulted in the chain reaction that we are witnessing today. Remember, we went through a two-week period of 72-hour protests, and you know that really put a lot of pressure on the administration to the extent that the IG goofed by saying that he was going to ban our protests. So they were under innumerable pressure. And I know that when the president went to the United Nations, he was also under pressure to do something. And that was why he had to capitulate, contrary to what he had said, that it was left to Boko Haram to look for negotiators. He had to talk to the United Nations to do something about it. And so we are very happy that we have been very strategic in our approach. We have taking steps depending on how situation unfolded from the time of Jonathan to the time of Buhari. And so we are the ones doing the protest. We are the ones who've been on the streets. And so we know the level of pressure we've had to increase or decrease at a given time. Outsiders who do not know what has happened and what is happening can make their own deductions. But we are very happy today that our pressure has paid off.
Some are saying that you should demand a meeting with the president or some government officials in cabinet to increase the pressure on them to demand the release of the other Chibok school girls. Any plans of such nature?
We had already given in our statement days ago, we had already said we were giving the government a month to watch events, and if after a month nothing had happened, we would go back on the street. So we'll watch. That statement has not changed. We'll still watch. The time is ticking. If nothing happens, we will explore all avenues, all legitimate avenues to ratchet up the pressure on the administration.
What's the next line of action of this Bring Back Our Girls campaign? Because I understand you are at the picketing site in Abuja where you usually protest to bring attention to the plight of these abducted Chibok school girls.
Yeah, we are here today as usual, as we've been coming out since the 15th day of the abduction. We have been coming out nonstop. And today is no different. We have come today. The only difference today is that we are seeing the fruit of our efforts. We are seeing that in Nigeria, you must hold your leaders accountable. If you do not hold them accountable, they will not do what they are supposed to do by the law of the land. And so we will continue to demand for the release and the rescue of the remaining 197 girls.
Emma Shehu is a leading member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign group. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotte from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. The United Nations has formally approved its next Secretary General. Antonio Guterres of Portugal will become the world body's ninth leader on January 1st, succeeding Ban Ki-moon, who leaves office at the end of this year. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
I now request the Chief of Protocol to escort the Secretary General Designate, His Excellency Antonio Guterres, to the platform.
The former Portuguese Prime Minister and former UN Refugee Agency chief said he feels humility and gratitude, as well as a profound sense of responsibility in the face of so many global challenges.
The dramatic problems of today's complex world can only inspire a humble approach, one in which the Secretary General alone neither has all the answers nor seeks to impose his views. One in which the Secretary General makes his good offices available, working as a convener, a mediator, a bridge builder, and an honest broker to help find the solutions that benefit everyone involved.
Guterres, who is 67 years old, was selected over 12 other candidates during a 10-month-long process that for the first time took place in the public eye and included an equal number of women candidates. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, have become the weapon of choice for the Somali rebel group Al-Shabaab, targeting soldiers and civilians alike. VOA's Jason Patinki went on patrol outside Mogadishu with African Union soldiers as they struggle to counter the growing IED threat.
African Union soldiers patrol a village outside Mogadishu. They are sweeping for improvised explosive devices, IEDs, planted by Al-Shabaab insurgents. The goal is to find and defuse any bombs before they go off. The AU troops, called Emisam, forced Al-Shabaab from most major towns during the past 5 years, but the rebels have regrouped. Using IEDs in ever larger attacks, they have managed to slow Emisam's advance.
IEDs are the biggest threat in this counter-insurgency, counter-terrorism operations. Al-Shabaab has been able to leverage its expertise on IEDs to very, very devastating effect.
Civilians are targeted too. Blasts at these hotels in late August killed 22. 2016 is set to be the worst year yet for IED attacks in Somalia, with more than 225, according to the Sahan Research Group. The bombs are getting bigger, too, up to 80 kilograms compared to 5 or 10 kilograms just a few years ago.
The use of IEDs has really evolved. IEDs are in different types. Trucks that are filled with explosives. They are pressure plate IEDs. There are also magnetic IEDs, IEDs that are remote control. And so a combination of these really creates a lot of challenge.
IEDs are effective because they are easy to make. Cell phones trigger explosives made from fertilizer and old munitions. Ball bearings and nails maximize carnage. The only imports are blast caps and detonators smuggled from Yemen, according to Amisom commanders and independent researchers.
They can place on a road, on the side of a road, and a vehicle. They are easily modified. They can easily be transported. They are easily connected. And the trigger man can easily hide. And that's why the IEDs they manufacture gives them a lot of flexibility.
Amisom officials and independent observers say patrols and searches aren't enough in places like Mogadishu, where attacks are most frequent. Better intelligence is needed to break up the bomb-making groups.
Keeping an eye on where potential IED factories may be, keeping an eye on where the materials are coming from. You know, if certain materials which are known IED components are visible in high quantities or running through the hands of certain people, that kind of intelligence can start to dismantle an IED network.
For AMISOM soldiers on the front lines, reducing the IED threat cannot come soon enough. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Female genital cutting has been widely denounced by global and non-governmental organizations. It is a practice that is deeply entrenched in some cultures, but a new study shows that attitudes can be changed through movie entertainment. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Female genital cutting occurs in many villages in Africa, as well as in Asia and the Middle East. Researchers say some 100 million women were circumcised as girls, and the procedure is carried out on between 2 and 3 million girls every year. Female genital cutting causes severe pain, excessive bleeding, poor healing, and urinary problems. Later, it can lead to problems with childbirth and even newborn death. The World Health Organization views it as a form of torture and a violation of the rights of children. In many cultures, female genital mutilation is religiously based. Many practitioners believe it reduces promiscuity in women, makes women more pure, and in patriarchal societies, more desirable for marriage. But a new study suggests that movies can change attitudes about female genital cutting, possibly leading to a reduction in the practice. Researchers at the University of Zurich showed 4 short films to a group of about 8,000 people in 127 villages in Sudan. The films depicted everyday conflicts within extended families. The movies, while they lacked Hollywood production values, featured professional actors, according to researcher Charles Efferson. He says there's a reason they chose to use movies to address the problem of female genital mutilation.
Entertainment can be an attractive tool for change because people like to be entertained, basically.
Investigators found that a short film examining cultural attitudes toward female circumcision involving elders in an extended family had the greatest impact. Issues around the marriageability of girls who had not been cut also seemed to change viewers' attitudes, at least temporarily, toward limiting or ending the practice. The findings were published in the journal Nature. Co-researcher Ernst Fair says it appears movies might be a more successful strategy to end female cutting than criminalization and global condemnation.
In a nutshell, our results show that entertaining movies that dramatize a family's internal strife about cutting can improve attitudes towards uncut girls.
The Swiss researchers say they want to follow up with the villagers in several months to see whether the films have led to more permanent attitudes against female circumcision. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar says the guarantors of the August 2015 peace agreement must call an urgent meeting of South Sudan political parties to address the current instability in the country. Machar told VOA in an exclusive interview on Thursday that there can be no peace in South Sudan until outstanding issues are resolved. And 21 newly freed Chibok girls kidnapped by Boko Haram in 2014 met with Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo Thursday in Abuja. Osinbajo denied press reports that the girls were swapped for 4 captured Boko Haram militants. And that's it for this Friday, October 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak. I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone a very good weekend.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at the role of the Darfur Women Action Group in Western Sudan. We'll discuss what key issues the organization is tackling in Darfur. That's next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Next on Let's Talk, we will talk about marriage. When is the right time to get married? What are the ingredients necessary to make marriage a successful, lasting partnership? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing marriage. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.